Meeting will come to order. We have four bills before us today, and we're going to start with Representative Benson. We love your enthusiasm, but we got to get this committee going. We got four bills. Okay, Representative Benson. We have session 11:30, members, just to remind you, while Representative Benson is coming to the table, let me just say there's a memo here from Jean LeFevre, our legislative analyst, who wants to correct some information about when a bill becomes effective last night. So please read that memo, I think. Just a favor for that. Here's a clarification. Doesn't make any difference to our deliberations last night, but it is something for future reference. Good morning, members. Representative Benson, welcome back to your committee. If you present your bill and the witnesses, we're going to try to move through the bill this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to be helpful in your efforts to move things forward, so
yes,
we're going to make this very quick.
Would you like to move your...
I would like to move House File 1387 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I believe this is what we're going to do.
To move House File 1387 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go forward.
Purpose of this bill is to invest additional funding into a long-term homeless supportive services fund, which will allow us to get closer to realizing the goals of the state's plan to end long-term homelessness. And with that, because of the time pressure, I'm going to turn this over to a number of presenters this morning.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the Executive Director of Heart Connection. Thank you for taking up this bill. I'd like to just take a brief moment to thank all of our supporters who came here today, providers and participants, counties and others, who show their support for this. House File 1387 appropriates $25 million to the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund, building on the work begun with the Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot. I'd like to describe the remarkable work being done around the state today and suggest what's possible if you appropriate $25 million for this fund. The legislature created a pilot in 2000 to evaluate whether pairing housing and services could effectively break the cycle of long-term homelessness. And to study participant outcomes and the impact on the utilization of government-funded services, especially crisis and institutional services like jails, detox, emergency rooms, hospitalizations, the pilot operates in Ramsey and Blue Ridge County. Here's how it works. We seek out people with very long histories of homelessness. Shelter workers and street outreach workers identify people who have multiple barriers to housing, including mental illness, chemical dependency, and disabling physical conditions. People who are sleeping in their cars, or in tents, or on the floors of shelters. We target people that other good programs in the community have not been able to help, and we have reached this group. 152 families and 109 single adults. Over 730 people have been a part of the pilot since 2001. The average length of time spent homeless before the pilot is 7.5 years for single adults and 2 years for families. They suffer from extremely high rates of mental and physical illness and chemical dependency. Heart Connection uses an innovative approach that makes securing permanent housing the first priority. A participant is supported by a team of professionals, first to help find housing, and once housed, to address other problems. These teams are operated by community social service agencies in Ramsey County and by the county itself in Bloor. These teams are mobile. They go out and work with someone wherever they are, in a shelter or living outside, in a hospital or in a jail, and eventually in their own home. They develop a one-on-one relationship. They identify housing options and help people move in, get furniture, and sign up for rental assistance. Using this model, 92% of pilot participants obtain housing within 18 months of enrollment, and 88% remain housed 1 year after. These teams support participants by helping get appropriate medical and psychiatric care, signing up for benefits like SSI, getting groceries, learning to cook, making plans for education and employment, reconnecting with family, and sometimes just being there to talk to. Once people are stably housed, they begin to achieve other goals. Over an 18-month period, we can document a 14% reduction in people experiencing mental health symptoms. That's the equivalent of experiencing one less mental health symptom a day, like having racing thoughts or hearing voices. A 49% reduction in the use of illegal drugs. Incomes rise 18%. 100% of children get enrolled in health insurance. Children who have witnessed and endured a frightening amount of violence begin to get the services that they need. Informed by the results of the pilot, the legislature created the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund in 2005. Instead of two counties, there are now 37 counties and six reservations operating five regional projects helping people experiencing long-term homelessness. Collectively, these programs are helping 650 households. But this is just 16% of the 4,000 households identified by the state's plan to end long-term homelessness. That's why we're here asking for $25 million for the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. $13 million is to sustain the capacity that we built with these programs and continue to serve the people who are in them. An additional $12 million would reach out to more people in need, both in the 37 participating counties and throughout the rest of the state. So in your packets, you will find a booklet that summarizes these programs, a set of sheets detailing some of the results of the program, our partners, and also a map of the regional project, some participant stories. Plus, I'd invite you to go online to heartconnection.org, where you can meet some participants to get more detailed evaluation results. There's also this amazing packet of letters from participants, counties, providers, and advocacy organizations asking you to invest $25 million in this fund. Thank you for your time and attention. We hope to have your support to house and successfully rehabilitate extremely vulnerable and underserved population. I'd now like to introduce Sarah Russo, a pilot participant who would like to share this story, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. My name is Sarah Russo. I'm a participant at the Heart Connection Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot, and Mental Health Resource is my provider I work with. Almost 1 year ago, who would ever thought that I'd be sitting here in front of you? On April 13, 2006, I jumped off a three-story building hoping to kill myself. I thank you for the opportunity today to tell you my life before that day and what has made a difference in the last year. At age 13, I ran away from home. The youngest and only girl out of seven, escaping an alcoholic and mentally ill mother and verbally and sexually abused family. That began 30 years of homelessness and a string of sexual abuse by my therapist, a parole officer, and a police officer, and others living on the street. I was caught up in prostitution as a way to survive. I couldn't trust nobody, and my life was worthless. Sometimes I would try to get arrested because prison was more secure than living underneath a bridge or living in a camp. Sometimes I would cut on myself because the physical pain would make me numb so I couldn't feel the emotional pain. Hopelessness made me very depressed. I would hear voices calling me very bad names, getting me into fights and winding up back in jail. My mental health battle, drugs and alcohol issues, and other self-destructive behavior came to a head a year ago. It was then that I wanted to end and jump off the building. I broke my collarbone and some ribs in the fall. I was hospitalized for a very long time. When I was discharged, I had no place to go and went back to the streets. I was still in pain, and it was harder to live outside than before. There was a warrant out for my arrest, so I decided to turn myself in and to get some kind of care and safety in jail. Then I got connected to the St. Paul Police Homeless Outreach Project. They have a house where people can make a transition from the street and can stay there for a while. I had been there for 7 months. This is the longest, safest, most stable time in my life. A nurse at the house told me about Heart Connection Pilot. I had been with the pilot for 5 months. The biggest thing the pilot gave me was the first Christmas I ever had. When I was 16, sober and not in jail and with my family. For the first time in my life, I had my very own apartment at the beginning of this month. I could never imagine this where I would have ever been. If you ask me what this program has made a difference, I would tell you that it's the trust, being able to depend on someone to help me, to learn to depend on myself. By keeping appointments, helping me stay on my medicine, being there to talk to when I feel like cutting myself, they show me that I am worth something. They teach me to keep track of my money and help me get clothes, access to food shelves, and they also have worked with the landlord to help me get the apartment I have now with my felony record. Because of the pilot, I have self-esteem, I believe in myself, and I love myself. My family also believes in me and loves me. I forgave my brothers for what they did to me, and I also am closer to my father. The pilots gave me hope. They gave me a life worth living. They've helped me have these things for the first time in my life. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Rosa.
Thank you, sir. And now I'd like to introduce Kenneth Amos, who also is a parent in the pilot program.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, Madam Chairperson, and members. Good morning. My name is Kenneth Amos. I'm a single father with two children. I work with the Wilder Foundation Project Quest as a part of Heart Connection Supportive Housing and Managing Care Pilot. I have two teenagers. My daughter is 13. My son was 15. I worked with Project Quest for about 6 years. At the time when I joined the program, I was in recovery from drugs and alcohol and had a hard time finding housing because of my credit history. I struggled through a cycle of homelessness, shelters, and shady landlords all at the time while keeping my kids with me. After a while, I lost my job due to issues I was facing coupled with chronic health problems. My health issues including I have two total hip replacements, both my rotator cuffs done, while damaged beyond repair. I recently went through the gastric bypass surgery, and as a result, I had life-threatening blood clots after the procedure. I've lost over 200 pounds. While risky, it was greatly improved my mobility and my overall health. Through it all, Project Quest has been instrumental in helping me with my kids, their school, maintaining housing, creating stability, and teaching me self-sufficiency. I am on public assistance and learning how to manage the little bit of money that I have is critical. They also taught me how to respect myself. Most programs would have stopped working with me after a certain time or wouldn't have put up with my difficulty as I was. I was pretty raw coming into the program. Excuse me. I started working with Project Quest. I was able and willing to grow in the beginning. Back then I didn't have a lot of hope. I didn't have help, and I didn't know how to receive help. Now I can receive help respectfully. I had skills and tools, but I didn't know how to use them. The best thing Project Quest has done for me is to help me make right choices, build strong relationships. I also was sexually abused, physically abused as a child. I turned to drugs and alcohol as a way to escape and to relieve the pressure that I felt when I wasn't understood. I've battled the addiction for 20 years out of my 49 years, and I am able to look at what it was all about. It was hard. But looking back, I see now that I am thankful. Even though I hadn't worked, I am proud of what I've done. I keep busy by volunteering, and I am now in the neighborhood leadership program, helping to organize and improve my community. I am proud of my children. My son is actively in the Upward Bound program and attends St. Olaf's College each summer to get college experience, and he is taking accelerated classes in high school. My daughter is an avid reader and is very good in foreign languages. She's a writer and wants to become a lawyer and a judge, or a judge, shall I say. I love being a parent. Right now, I'm getting back into the swing of things. I'm able to prepare meals like breakfast and dinner. Gives me a chance to talk to my children and spend time with my children with quality time. they know the difference between me being a parent and when I'm being a friend, and I have to separate the two because it can be difficult at times. I don't know where I would be if I didn't follow through with this program. It is easy to leave, but I've learned how to, I learned that I need help, and it's worth it for my kids. I need to be to pay attention to their needs and to set an example. With Project Quest, my kids are so far ahead of the game compared to where I was. My brother and I had an interesting conversation. He told me that, or he asked me, you know, would I be the kind of man that I would want my daughter to bring home? And I am that kind of man because I have a home. Heart Connection and Project Quest have helped me to show me that I can be that kind of man. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to hear from Kelly Harder, Human Services Director from Steele County.
And then definitely want to move along. These are very, very compelling stories, and I didn't in any way want to cut them off. If we can move a little faster, maybe with the rest, that would be helpful. But I have to say, very, very compelling stories. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I will be brief, I guarantee. My name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Director of Human Services for Steele County. Prior to that, I was an Assistant Director in Blue Earth County and had the great opportunity of being on the front end of the pilot initiative, by which started back in 2000, and now you see many of the lives involved and the stories. Let me just say this. From a county standpoint, we too are stewards of taxpayer dollars. I sit and ask, what is a good investment in return on a taxpayer dollar? I can say quite confidently, and by the stories you hear today, and there's many, many hundreds of others, is that this is a sound tax investment, and the return on it. The return on it is life. So it's a quality of life. It's an improved quality of life. It's more than just investing in a program. This is investing in an effective ability to provide opportunity for individuals that may have struggled at achieving success in what I call the traditional system of human services, the traditional mental health system, the traditional child welfare system, correction system. They've struggled in those systems. And this has created another opportunity. It has created opportunities so high-level cost interventions like detox, emergency rooms, the correctional system, they aren't being used. We're using preventative care. We're using alternatives. It is very cost-effective from the taxpayer standpoint. So I thank you for your support, and I'd be willing to answer any questions on behalf of the counties and would also like to turn it over to Commissioner Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Harder.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and to Heart Connection. The results that they've shown that you've heard about.
Mr. Dorfman, you need to. Everybody doesn't know that you're
probably
a wonderful commissioner from Hampton County. So please.
Madam Chair, Gail Dorfman. I'm on the Hennepin County Board. I also chair our Housing and Redevelopment Authority and co-chaired our 10-year plan to end homelessness called Heading Home Hennepin. Thank you for that. So I want to thank Heart Connection. I mean, the results that you've heard about today that have been shown in Blue Earth and Ramsey County, the evaluation of this pilot, it's really been a great resource for the rest of us as we try to end homelessness throughout all of our communities. And it's been particularly challenging in Hennepin because of the size and the magnitude of the problem in homelessness in Minneapolis. Well, we've made great strides through first our Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, where we've prevented homelessness for many families and gotten families out of shelter who do become homeless to such an extent that we've reduced shelter stays for families by 70%. And now through the Supportive Services Fund, we have a truly unique regional partnership working together, aligned with the state business plan to end homelessness, and we're already showing incredible results in getting the chronically homeless off our streets, out of shelter, and into stable, permanent housing. We recently completed a study of repeat users that you've heard about of expensive institutional settings in Hennepin, shelter, jail, detox. What we found, amazing numbers, over the past 4 years, 266 individuals accounted for 68,000 days of shelter, jail, and detox. 60 of those individuals accounted for half of those days. We know who these individuals are who are chronically homeless. We see them daily. And now we have a tool in place to break that cycle, and it's working. Cities and counties across the state are stepping up to change their paradigm from managing homelessness to ending it. We're doing it every day. We've developed 10-year plans. We're holding Project Homeless Connect events. We're investing in affordable and supportive housing. We're doing our part and more, and we thank the state for being an important partner in this effort. The state support we've received has helped us leverage public and private sector support and to really engage the entire community in this effort. Just last week, Jim Polad, on behalf of his family foundation, announced a $1 million gift to the business plan to help end homelessness. And last week, I testified on Capitol Hill urging members of Congress to join us at the state and local level in this partnership through passage of additional federal money, Section 8, McKinney-Vento, and creation of a National Housing Trust Fund. We know what works. We know how to end homelessness for single adult families and youth, and we're moving that direction every day in Hennepin County and elsewhere across the state. But to bring it to scale and to achieve the goals of our 10-year plan and the state business plan, we urge you to support the $25 million in House File 1387. It's both morally just, it's economically sound, it's the right thing to do as we work together to end homelessness in the state of Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I would just conclude by saying the studies clearly show that if we can secure stable housing for the homeless, then many of these other problems that we have been hearing about can be better addressed. And this bill, I see, is an investment. This is an investment which will save the state, the counties, our communities money. Approximately $100,000 is spent on a homeless person on average. This program is very, very cost effective. Instead of spending $100,000, how about $5,000 to $20,000? It's an enormous savings, even if we do not consider the human costs that we are heard about today. The Long-Term Homeless Support Fund I support because it's leveraged. We get a dollar for every dollar we invest from other sources. The services the most vulnerable in our society, those who have been homeless for 5 years or more. And more importantly for many, these results are documented. And that's very, very important. I think we can show the voters and the taxpayers of the state that we can document savings and that we can document success. So thank you, Madam Chair.
I want to ask questions from committee members. I know I have one. Commissioner, I want to thank you for taking our voice to Washington. Do you have any hope for us in terms of this particular bill bringing match? And I think that would be an important thing for us to know. Representative Benson mentioned it leverages one-to-one, but I'm guessing that doesn't include federal dollars. If the federal dollars are accounted, what are we talking about? I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, actually, just last week, we had a press conference with HUD. HUD has granted $1.96 million to Heart Connection to support rental assistance. And those rental assistance dollars, purely federal dollars, pair with these service dollars. In fact, what we're finding is that we're actually getting rental assistance from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and HUD at a faster pace than we're able to keep up with services. And that's why it's so critical to put money into this long-term homeless service fund.
And Madam Chair, if I might just add, the message I heard in Washington is that members of Congress get that it doesn't make sense to look at mental health parity and other issues. They're looking at education issues if people don't have stable housing. So they get it's all linked. And the housing piece is important. HUD has backed off. We're pleased with the McKinney-Vento dollars, but HUD has been backing off of supporting housing since the 1980s, and our delegation gets that it's time to get back at the table with us in this work.
Okay. Madam Chair, can I just also, at a local level, I mean, these are federal and at a very local level, we're actually having landlords, successful landlords, line up to say, I want to be attached to this project, and I will leverage my resources to help those that are in our mental health case management, for example. So it trickles all the way.
Thank you. Representative Shumper?
Yes, Madam Chair. Witnesses, what's the governor's recommendation for this project, for this program?
Madam Chair, Representative Tremper.
No.
The proposal in the governor's budget is for $13 million for the biennium, which is the amount needed to continue to support people who have been in the supportive housing and managed care pilot and continue to operate the five regional programs. So going above $13 million is what we need in order to do more, to build on the momentum and the results of the program thus far.
Okay, unless there's any further discussion, the motion is amended this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Bill.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we could delay our filing until after the next two, because Director Stein is trying to get someone from the MPCA to address something for us.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, obviously we've had a lot of discussion in the previous bill. So I'd just like to thank you all for coming. Come back and go see the governor on your way out. That's my suggestion.
All right, we're going to keep moving on here, folks. So as you are exiting, please be mindful of us trying to get our job done here. Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hold on. We do have more bills in the docket to get through. Representative Clark.
This will be hopefully pretty brief.
Okay, let's try to keep it to about 15 or less.
Be shorter than that.
All right.
This bill is a bill that actually provides that that our three state agencies work together. And let me just tell you, this bill made it to the floor and was in a conference committee 2 years ago.
Representative Clark, I don't mean to interrupt
you. I'm going to move House Bill 1407.
Okay.
Excuse me. Thank you.
We are moving this for
possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And I'll just mention again, this bill actually has been in this legislature before and was actually in the conference committee 2 years ago. And this lacked one vote to go into state law. So we're back today to ask again that require that three state agencies that deal with issues of toxic exposure and health issues, connections between them, that they work together and that they share their information. They track possible connections between exposure to environmental toxins and public health consequences, disparities that we already know about and others that may be still to be revealed. So this says that the commissioner shall coordinate this project with the commissioner of health, coordinate this project with the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Agriculture, and also look to the federal government for possible funding to renew this effort or actually to expand it and to promote public health tracking, which I had a conversation with one of the members from the Department of Health last night saying that they are actually interested in the public health tracking. And there's another bill that's much more specific about this. This is more generic. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. And I hope committee members will look kindly on it. We can include it in our omnibus bill.
Wonderful. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify to this point? Seeing none, any questions from members? Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, what kind of diseases or issues does this help track? Can you be a little bit specific?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swales.
Representative Clark.
Right now we have at our Department of Health an area called the Multicultural Minority Health Division, I believe it's called. And within that, they're responsible for reporting a lot of diseases. And we know that there are disproportionate numbers of illnesses in certain communities of color. You know that children, for example, have asthma at very high rates. One of the issues, and the Department of Health right now actually is doing some tracking in the area of asthma. It's one of the only areas they are doing. We want them to do that in additional areas, which would include things like cancer, some of the other kinds of heart disease and illnesses that, when you look at the Minority and Multicultural Health grid, you can see diabetes. There's a lot of different kinds of diseases that are disproportionately impacting groups that happen to live in communities that have toxins. So it's not limited to the ones I just mentioned. We've got things popping up out in Representative McNamara's area, you know, that we want to find out whether or not there's some relationship to the toxic exposures that's going on out there. This is broad enough to be worded that the Department of Health can use, hopefully, those federal funds to track any of the kinds of toxic exposures that are either now that we're aware of or others that still to be revealed.
A follow-up then.
Representative Swales.
Is there a financial impact of this thing?
Representative Clark.
I sure hope so. We really want the Department of Health to get federal funding to bring that to their table. Whether or not there's going to be any additional fiscal note from the department, I haven't heard, and I'm certainly interested in seeing if there is, but I have not received any information on that.
Great.
I imagine they can observe this. They're going to have to get together and share information and use some of the existing GIS mapping and other sorts of resources that are somewhat online. If they need more additional resources, we're going to need to hear that from them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, see, there's the Department of Health in the audience. Could we hear from them about this bill?
Sure, I think that'd be a great idea.
Representative Clark.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and there would be no fiscal impact to the Department of Health for applying for the federal funds, and we assume that any cost we would need to carry out the provisions of the bill, we would include in the federal application and would be provided by the Fed.
Wonderful. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much funding is available from the feds, do you know? How much we would be looking at for helping out with this situation?
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I am not sure what the federal government is currently making available in this area, but we can find that out.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. I'm just curious if you could maybe talk a little bit about the language in here, and so it would be more clear to me anyway. You're referring to expanding the state's environmental justice's management capacity. Is that capacity, does it already exist? I mean, are we doing environmental justice mapping now? And kind of explain what that process currently entails and how this was going to...
Representative Clark. Thank you for that question. We have done some in the past. We've had both federal dollars and the departments themselves, for example, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency had an environmental justice mapping project that we received federal dollars for. And when those dollars ran out, they still continued a portion of that. And my understanding from that organization, from the Pollution Control Agency, which we don't have their budget before, they still, they've actually hired a new person to do some of that work. I met her, she came to my office. I think a person, two half-time persons, actually. So I know that agency for sure has capacity. Our own Minnesota Department of Health, in terms of their efforts to do public health tracking, my understanding is that they do some of that right now with asthma. They're interested in doing more of that. There's another bill that's going to be coming to this committee that deals with public health tracking, and I hope we'll put some additional dollars in. The Department of Agriculture deals with the pesticide toxins that are separate from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's an unusual state dividing up of responsibility, I have to say. And one of the problems is it's all divided up. And until we start putting that together, we're not going to make some of those links. So when this bill actually was in the conference committee, I was told by the agencies they could voluntarily do this. They said, don't give us a requirement. Let's voluntarily do that. That was 2 years ago. They have not voluntarily done it. So I'm back with the bill now, and I think they've got some resources. Hopefully, in another bill coming through, we'll put some additional resources.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's something that would be fairly easy to take what we currently have and compile it into a more usable form. I wonder, is there, it would be interesting to just look at a piece of something that we already do that would kind of be what we're talking about here in environmental justice map. I mean, I guess so, if there's...
Mr. Chairman, if you're asking for some discussion, that maybe after we get past deadlines, we can ask for some of the agencies to come in and look at and give us some presentations. In fact, some of it, I'm sure, is available. I'd even be able to bring it up on the screen.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that.
Wonderful. Good discussion on this. The motion was to lay this into the omnibus bill or for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill, and we will take that action.
Mr. Chairman, I'd next like to move House Bill 1842.
And where would we be moving that to?
That will be to stay here in our committee, Mr. Chair, to be for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you. To your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, some of the language of this is familiar to you because it's similar to what was in the birth defect registry system that we want to make sure that we can gather the kinds of information to make our cancer registry actually meaningful. Right now, it's a fairly shallow instrument. It collects very limited information. There's no information that is collected when there is a cancer diagnosis in our state on the person's residence other than their current residence. There's nothing about where they may have worked or been exposed to any toxic environments, either in the home, workplace, or anywhere else that they may possibly be aware of. There's just no really tracking, I guess, of any of the possible connections to environmental toxic exposures. We also add military service as one of the experiences that we want to make sure that we capture in this database. What I've done in this bill, because of our discussion around the Cancer Birth Defects Registry, I think we... Let me change some language here. I'm not seeing that language. We do say that this is private data on individuals. Mr. Chairman and members, I know that we changed the time of question of that data, and I'm not sure if we need to do that here. Oh, yes, we did change it. Excuse me. It does say that on line 22. Shall offer the patient with the patient's informed consent. That was an effort to address the concern that came up when we were talking about the birth defects registry. So, Mr. Chairman, I know there's a fiscal note from the Department of Health. They came to talk to me about it last night because it was such an amazing fiscal note. They were worried that I would think that they were trying to sabotage the bill. And I said, well, you know, let's talk about it in the committee today. And I think you should hear it. My intent is to get started on this, and there may need to be a phased-in requirement here. I also question some of the numbers. I'm not going to ascribe an intent to the Department of Health, but this has been an issue over the years that the director of the Cancer Registry has always opposed collecting this kind of data. I think it's essential to have the Cancer Registry ask some of these real basic questions about where people may have been exposed to environmental toxins. So I actually... I think the Department of Health system is going to talk about that should probably come down. Maybe there's other questions from committee members in the meantime if you do have
any other questions while she's coming down. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how is this different than how we currently do? How is this different than how we currently do business? I mean, is it that it's a mandate on
it? It would be very. Chair, Representative.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Mary Manning. I'm the Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease with Cancer Surveillance System. It's within the division that I oversee. I also have with me John Soler. He's one of the epidemiologists that works on the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. He knows more of the technical details than I do, so I asked him to come along. As far as is it very different than how we do business, it's very different. Right now, we do not speak with a cancer patient that's in the registry. We get 25,000 reports. There's 25,000 cases of cancer in the state each year. We look at reports that come from pathologists and clinics across the state, and we'll get maybe 100,000 or more different types of reports. We bring them into the system. And some of them are duplicates because some come from labs, some come from hospitals, and they might be on the same patient. And we collect 1,000 different pieces of information that's part of the National Cancer Registry's standards. And we put them in this database. And we make sure that the data's there. We have abstractors that go across the state to look into the medical records to verify different pieces of information of that 1,000 pieces of information that goes into this big computerized system. And then the system is utilized by researchers for different functions across a lot of different functions. Like people will ask us if they could look at the link between adult leukemia and pesticides or steroids. And somebody will hypothesize a research question like that, get permission from a group of people who peer review the validity of their question, and then we will provide them with some of the access they need to some of the data in the cancer surveillance system. We actually do not talk to patients without the doctor's consent. So, and that usually is only in relation to a research project. So this proposal would mean that we would have to find, as it's written now, we would have to contact the physician, ask them if we are okay to contact the patient. And I'm not sure if that's what Representative Clark wants us to do or if she wants some other mechanism for that to happen. And we can discuss that. But right now, that's where one of the big costs is trying to contact the physician and make sure that it's okay for, in their mind, for us to contact the patient to even do this interview.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, ma'am, I didn't catch your name again. I'm sorry.
Mary Manning.
Ms. Manning. I guess one of the questions I have, there's is that 25,000 new cases
every
year?
Yes, it is.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Manning, how many FTEs do you have currently?
We have 30 FTEs in the cancer surveillance system, 10 of which are approximately 10, which are paid with federal dollars, 16 that are paid for with general fund dollars, and approximately 3 to 4, it's kind of general, that we have on staff that are paid through contractual relationships, like the leukemia and that study. Somebody's paying us to have somebody look through, because we don't have the capacity just to look through and mine the data for them. We have a contract, and that part of their research project is to pay us to go have a piece of somebody look through that information. So that's what we have on staff right now.
Okay. Representative Stevenson.
And about how long, when you contact a patient to get the information from, how long do you spend with that patient?
Ms. Manning? Mr. Soler. Just introduce yourself to the committee.
John Soler, senior epidemiologist with the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, we don't actually spend any time with the patient. It would be the researcher, usually from the University of Minnesota or the Mayo Clinic, who has contracted with us for permission to have access to the names of, for example, the current study of a certain type of leukemia. Is it associated with certain kinds of pesticides, herbicides, genetic defects, this sort of thing? In this case, Dr. Ross, who's heading up this study at the university, once we contact the physician of record, which is no small task, and get permission to contact the patient, then the researcher, as an agent of the commissioner, does the contacting. In that specific study, the interview is about an hour long, but some studies it may be a half hour, other studies that are even more involved may even be a couple hours. It just depends on the study that is being done.
And with our experience, and it's almost a standard across the country in looking at, and when you have an interview that takes 1 hour with the patient, the standard is that it takes 3 to 4 hours of either travel time, prep time, follow-up time, getting missing pieces of information. That's kind of a standard across the country.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just taking the overwhelming numbers in sometimes, I mean, 25,000, if you got 30 FTEs, that's about 750 cases per FTE at 5 to 6 hours. Per, you know, then you're talking about two per day, 5 to 6 hours. Current structures, I don't think it could be done if you're working every day. So I think it's, although I understand the kind of the issue on the bill here, and I don't think it's a bad one. I think logistically it's huge.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark?
I certainly wouldn't propose to do it with the existing folks. That's why the bill's before you, and that's why we did ask for a fiscal note, and that would have to be appropriated dollars that we would put into the system. I do want to just say I think there's another amendment that probably needs to come here because of some of the discussion we had at the previous one, and maybe Representative Madora can help me, but I think on line 2.1 we probably want to take out at the time of diagnosis of cancer. Is that right, Representative Madora? Would that, you know, I didn't get a chance to talk about this today, but I'm thinking you had a concern about at the time. Am I correct on that or not?
Representative Madora.
I'm sorry, Representative Clark. Would you
look on line?
I had a hard time hearing you.
That's
Clark.
Okay. Line 2.1. I know we changed in the when we were looking at the birth defects registry the language that I think that had to do at the time of, and I'm wondering, is that something we should do with this bill here? We did add the concern about making sure that it was the patient's informed consent, but I'm just wondering. Mr. Chairman, we can tweak this later. I guess I just wanted to raise it as an issue that I wanted to be sensitive to, and I'm, Representative Madora, maybe if you don't have an answer now, that's okay.
Representative Madora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Clark, there was not an issue at
okay.
cancer.
Okay.
It was the issue at the time of diagnosis of a fetus. So.
All right, I just thought it may have been a terrible issue.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, let me just say the answer to Representative Stevenson's question was if there is a research project that's determined later, it's very different from what I'm proposing in this bill, which is that we gather the data while it's fresh, rather than waiting for 10, 15 years for someone to decide, let's go back and see how many leukemia cases there were in Stearns County in X year. It has never been gathered, and those people have moved on. You know, we have a mobile population. You will never know. We will never be able to understand what connections there might be. Now, Stearns County is the best of places because you've got people who might be there longer than certain places. Or Rock County, where my father has lived for 91 years. Okay, but you get a place like the metro area, and if you haven't, if we haven't in any way tried to understand when people live in certain places and when they might be exposed to various types of cancer, we don't have any way to go back and retrieve that information. We've got years and years, decades sometimes, of lost information. And I can tell you in my own case, my own name on the cancer registry, which I'm happy to say was more than 6.5 years ago, has none of this information. No one would knew that I grew up in Rock County where I played with DDT, you know, I was exposed to other farm issues. You know, none of that is gathered. There's absolutely none of that information being put there. So, for example, we have this health department who a few years ago put out a report that said there's no connection between pesticides and cancer. Based on what? We never gathered any information in our cancer registry to find out if people were exposed to pesticides. And this would say we're going to start gathering that information if there's a known or possibly known exposure. So I'm only using pesticides because it's the hot issue today with some of the things that are going on. But there are many, many issues that I think relate to this.
Thank you. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the fact that we have such a mobile nation. People move from state to state very, very frequently. Is there a national registry? And how would, I mean, if we really beef up the registry that we have, would that interface with other states?
There isn't a...
Ms. Manning.
Do you want to answer this question?
Sure. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stoller.
Representative... Sorry?
Swales.
All right. Thank you. Pardon me. The All of the states with registries, which are the vast majority of them, report their numbers to the Centers for Disease Control, and a certain section down there compiles them, and they eventually end up in the NIH. However, those are all de-identified, so one could not say this person in Minnesota who has now moved to Florida or Wisconsin, that you could do some sort of tracking in that way. Now, each state is responsible when they collect a case to make sure that it has actually been diagnosed in their state and not previously in some other state. So in theory, there shouldn't be duplication. Of course, in practice, one never knows for sure, and there certainly must be errors, but by and large, but it would be a de-identified listing.
Representative Swales.
I'm an English teacher, and I've never heard de-identified, so you'll have to forgive me.
Without personal identifiers, no names.
Okay. Okay, that helps. Okay. I guess what I'm trying to find out then, would we be, blazing a trail here, Representative Clark?
Yes, we have part of the...
Ms. Manning?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have looked with at all the other states. No one else in the country is collecting this information. And part of it is it's a very expensive piece of information to collect, and it's very comprehensive. And I have to admit, what we gave to Representative Clark is huge. Even a study like the one that's very tailored, like the one Mr. Scholler is working on with the university, is costing millions of dollars, and they're looking at one piece. And so they're taking just those cases of leukemia and just those exposures, and it's costing $1 million. And it's that's why it hasn't been done this way across the country. The other thing is, across the country, they are doing work on what's called environmental health tracking, and they're trying to get systems and standards developed. And they have 18 states in the country who have some federal money from the CDC that is starting to develop those types of standards that we should try to collect more uniformly and to be able to link those with things like the cancer surveillance system and other data from PCA or other things. They're trying to come up with standard nomenclature and standards.
Wonderful. Okay, members, we have four people who want to speak. We have 5 minutes to get through this, so we are going to try to keep this tight. So, Representative Shumper.
Yes, I just want to say I think Representative Clark is absolutely right in this bill. The immediacy of collecting this data is the only way you can have timely responses to it and identify hotspots and other things. I would just like, and I was thinking the same thing Representative Severson was. I was running numbers in my mind about the cost of this. Wouldn't you be able to somehow train, rather than have public health nurses do this, couldn't you train people to do that under the supervision of a single public health nurse or something and save some costs that way? Because that's where the real cost is going to be, it seems to me, in the time spent gathering the data.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shumper, if you notice on line 2.3, it says the public health nurse or other qualified individuals to interview the patient. And that's exactly what we thought. It was a training program that could easily be put into place here. I'm not trying to spell out all the details on this. I want our health department to be creative. And I think one of the other things to say is maybe we do need to start with a pilot. But I would hope that what we would do would be a comprehensive pilot, not a shallow one that only singles out a certain disease. We will not get at the issue if we don't start to understand possible connections.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about this issue and regarding the information. The information you're talking about, I mean, you spell it out as being private data on individuals. Does the public health, the Commissioner of Public Health now have permission to go to a doctor and request information about their patients? I mean, where does patient-doctor confidentiality come in here? I guess, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because I think, you know, there's some huge benefits that could come if we could do this and do it in a way that people would really get on board with. But I think there is a lot of concern in people's mind when we start taking their private data and we start figuring out ways to use it in ways that they maybe aren't totally aware of. I mean, the consent form that you're talking about in here is a pretty informal consent, and it just seems like we could, that whole issue, we need to massage a little bit and figure out how to make it more clear so people feel more comfortable with their information being out there. But maybe you could comment on that.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, you know, I guess if there's language to clarify that, I'd be happy to work with you on it.
But could the department ask, could they answer my question about whether they have that authority now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland.
Mr. Chair.
We do have statutory authority to collect specific items. Some we don't have, for example, telephone number, we don't have the authority to demand, so to speak, that be given. Other things that are essential, for example, the person's name, there's address, social security number, the type of cancer that they have. We do have statutory authority for, and actually we do collect nearly 1,000 fields of data, which include many things that would be mumbo jumbo to you because it's all medical classifications of the type of cancer.
Wonderful. Representative Madore.
Mr. Chair, could I just, he didn't totally answer my question. I want to just get at one other issue. That
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department has that authority, but do doctors have the legal obligation to give you that information?
Mr. Soler.
Yes, they do.
Ms. Manning.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, they do. All cancer is reportable to all doctors. The pathologies clinics that do the diagnosis, they are required to report it to the State Health Department.
Thank you. Representative Madore.
Thank you. Very quick, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clark, our testifiers. Do we ever send out updates asking how the patient is doing today so that you can tell if there's some other health issues that have continued on or perhaps a new cancer has developed? Or would they be put in the database, say a different cancer is developed, and do they go in the database now twice with the new diagnosis, or are they updated, their record updated?
Mr. Soler.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Madore,
thank you. To answer the last question first, if a person has a second diagnosis of cancer, yes, we do get that reported to us. We essentially collect cancers, not people, although people are attached to the cancers, and so we have that information too. But we really count cancers. And the first part of your question?
Did you do any follow-up?
Really, the only follow-up we do is passive follow-up. So we will look through death certificates to see if somebody has died, both the Minnesota Vital Records and the NDI, the National Death Index.
Very short. Representative Madore.
Very short. Mr. Chair and testifiers, then again, so what we're looking at is that somebody could be in the the cancers are in the database, but for example, if a woman is first diagnosed with breast cancer and then dies of brain cancer because it's spread to her, that the cancers would be in there twice, but we have no way right now of linking that one woman is responsible for those two cancer reporting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Madore, no, we do have a way because we have her name and social security number and other bits of date of birth, other bits of information where we can link the two together and we see, this is the same person. We count that cancer once. If that same cancer is spread to the brain, it's actually not counted as two cancers. It has to be a separate starting point.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Quick, I have not heard the number. I have not heard the financial number that people have testified to as to what is in
the reason, I don't think
Representative
it's shared. I think, I don't know. It's a fantastic number, and I think it should go on the record.
The number that we came up with was
Mr.
Chair, Representative, the number we came up with was approximately $4.5 million. Presently, we spend $2 million on the cancer surveillance system as it is. That money comes, $1.1 million comes from general fund, and approximately $900,000 and some other contracts we have come from the federal government.
Thank you.
And that's not unusual for what states pay for their cancer surveillance system.
I just want to say I would like to get back to you with let you know what other states are doing. They're not breaking brand new ground. We can talk about that more in the omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm. Great. So Representative Clark renews that motion that this be laid into the omnibus bill, and we will act on that, taking that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So done. The last bill we have, folks, is Representative Swales. House File 1980. Representative Swales, just so you're aware, we do have about 15 minutes, and then we sprint to the Capitol.
I can be concise at times.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to move House File 1980 to be moved to Finance Committee and hopefully to the floor.
Okay. So the motion is to pass this and send it to Finance.
Correct.
Thank you. To your bill.
Before we discuss the bill, there are three brief oral amendments I would like to make to it. If you would look at line 1.6, if you would change the number from 570,000 to 593,000, if you would delete July 1st, 2007, and include day after enactment, then that matches the effective date 1.12. The third amendment is on line 1.7. You would please scratch general and replace general with remediation. Now the bill is in the shape that I would like it to be presented.
Okay, let's see if we can have staff read back that amendment. Just so we're all clear on it, we'll vote on it and then get it the way you want it.
Mr. Chair and representatives, on line 1.6, it says now $593,000 is appropriated to the fiscal in the fiscal year beginning the day following final enactment.
Correct.
And then on line 1.7, it says remediation fund rather than general fund.
Correct.
Okay, any questions to the amendment members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, Representative Swales, we have it in the order you'd like. Now to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Clark.
I think that there was a question about is the word final before the word evaluation on that amendment? Final enactment, excuse me. Is the word final before that? Okay, we just missed that.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
Thank you. I've invited Representative McNamara up here to join me today because both of us are very concerned about issues that have been raised in South Washington County related to the PFCs, particularly the PFOAs, the PFOS, and PFVA chemicals that have been found in our drinking water in those communities. We have invited Director Stein here to speak directly to the bill, but I do want you to know that this is a bill that we feel will allow the Department of Health to do the job they need to do in order to find a solution to the water problems that we're experiencing in our communities. Director Stein.
Director Stein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Stein. I'm Director for Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. The bill, as drafted, would provide funding to the department to conduct an independent evaluation of approximately 6 to 10 different water treatment filter methodologies, ranging from point-of-use filters, which are the screw-on-the-end-of-your-faucet type of filter you could purchase at any home goods store, to a more whole-house-based system. There is currently no national standard for or study that has been conducted that would identify the efficacy of these treatment systems. And there's a disparity among what some treatment system companies are claiming in the communities as to what's actually been studied and documented. So this project is to provide up to 1,200 different samples of water at known concentration through these filtration devices
in separate compounds as well as in mixtures of these compounds to look for what systems work and how well they work under various circumstances. That will do two things. That will provide agencies like Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Minnesota Department of Health with information about future remediation actions that might be helpful or appropriate in these communities, as well as set some standard among the industry participants that will know what types of systems actually work and what don't work. And we are prepared to implement the study as soon as funding would become available. We heard a lot about a number of questions at the community meetings that were held across South Washington County. Questions from homeowners, questions from community leaders, questions from water treatment companies looking for this kind of information. So we're very interested in pursuing this.
Representative Swales?
One of the reasons that we have included the remediation fund, a question I had, and I appreciate Representative McNamara's dogging it for me. The remediation fund is a fund that is one that then could be reimbursed. And so if you could explain how that mechanism works, that would be good.
Director Stein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The remediation fund is a fund that is managed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I, when the question was asked of me this morning, is this cost eligible for first for the expense out of the remediation fund, and whether the cost could be then recovered from a responsible party under the provisions of the state Superfund law, I called the commissioner's office in MPCA, and they said it sounded to them like it would be cost recoverable, that these costs are eligible for uses from the fund, and that if they would support future remediation actions, that could then be charged against the responsible party. MPCA is willing to follow that up in writing for the committee if that's something that is of interest, but I just got asked a question by Representative McNamara and Representative Swales this morning, so we called them and just got the answer about 15 minutes ago. But it does look like it would therefore be a reimbursable cost that the remediation fund could recoup.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, so my understanding is this should not come out of our budget then, the $592 million.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clark. That certainly is our intent. The reason the need for these filters to be studied is, as Representative Swell said, the current information that's come about in our communities in the East Metro based on findings in the ground that should not be paid for by general fund. They should be paid by the responsible party, and that's the idea. And we've got that confirmation from MPCA, and it'll be coming forward to this committee in writing. It's our intent and desire that this bill move forward to the floor as soon as possible so the Department of Health could begin this study right away so that we could get the information to provide to our constituents based on the filters that they would like to buy, and we can get more information for them. And it's only right that the responsible party pay for this, not the general fund.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark.
I have to agree with you, but I think this does take this to the Environment Finance Committee because they're the ones who manage that fund and we don't. And perhaps, that, you know, I know they're meeting and this could go through them quickly, but I think until that happens, there's no assurance that 3M is going to ante up this money. And so I would advise the author to get this bill moved there as quickly as possible from this committee.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Shumper.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you clarify for me, is this a study about whether to use point of entry or point of use, or is it to check whether these actual types of filters work for this compound? Are these carbon filters of some kind?
Director Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shumper, yes. We're looking at the range of filtration methods from reverse osmosis to a combination of activated carbon and reverse osmosis. All we would look to an industry group such as the National Sanitation Foundation or the Water Quality Association to contract with a
private lab to do these tests, or to have the tests run by the Minnesota Department of Health lab, which I believe we designed the study at this point to come through the Minnesota Department of Health lab for sampling of the water. And it would run the range of compounds individually as well as in combination.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, so you don't really know right now which filters work. Is that correct?
Director Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumper, we have tested point-of-use filters, the small faucet-based filters. We've done tests limited to waters that are delivered through Cottage Grove's water system and South St. Paul Park's water system. We know that they work for a period of time. We've sampled a number of the filters, and we've tried them on a number of different homes, and we have results that would indicate they do work, but there's breakthrough of the compounds after a certain number of hours of use.
Representative Schumper.
Quick one last. Can I urge you to be sure to inform the public about that variability? Because I think a lot of people will put these on and think they're going to work and not service them or maintain them. And so was it the osmotic ones worked, or the activated carbon ones, or did they all work to some degree, or what?
Director Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumper, we only tested activated carbon units, point-of-use filters only, the inexpensive ones. We did not test other forms of filters at this time.
Thank you.
Hey. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify to this bill? Just wanted to give that opportunity out there. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stein, have they ever used black light on the water filtration system along with the reverse osmosis to have an effect on the water?
Director Stein?
Chair, Representative, I'm sorry.
Anderson.
Anderson, I am not familiar with that. I apologize. I'd have to go back and ask. It sounds like it's there's ultraviolet treatment.
Yeah, similar to that.
That is used on larger scale water treatment systems. I'm not familiar with any systems that are in-home ultraviolet, but I could ask the staff and see if there are smaller scale systems that use that technology.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay. So, seeing no other questions here, I believe the motion that Representative Swales would like to renew is that this pass out of this committee and be sent to finance. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, we'd like it to go to finance. If they recommend that it go to environmental health finance or the environment, then we will take it.
Okay.
Chairman,
we
may even be able to get that done today, so I think you might want to. Okay. I could try to help you with that later. Thank you.
Wonderful. So this bill is before us to pass and go to the Committee on Finance. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And you're on your way. We do need to move the minutes before you guys all run out of here to the Capitol.
For the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark moves the minutes. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Yes, Mr. Clark.
Motion carries. We have the minutes are approved, and we are... Representative Clark, announcement.
I just want to remind people that we're meeting tomorrow. At 10 o'clock, we have a speaker who will be coming in from California to talk with us about Representative Schumper's bill, and I just urge members to come. It's going to be a very exciting and very enlightening presentation. So please, members, please all be sure to come.
Wonderful. With that, we are adjourned.